This call is being recorded.
Morning, everybody. This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and we have a conference call this morning with three interesting presenters talking about renewable energy issues related to rural areas. Our first presenter is going to be Sherry Gruder with the University of Wisconsin Extension Office, followed by Myra Moss at Ohio State University Extension, and then Matthew Marshall from the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. So, Sherry, why don't you go ahead and start us out?
Okay, great. So, my topic is about what's happening with renewable energy and solar, especially in rural Wisconsin. And it's been a huge success story in the last year. Solar, the Wisconsin solar industry job growth in 2016 increased 45%, which I think the average job growth increase is about 0.5%. So this was really huge, and it grew to 2,800 workers. While we know that through a report that was done based on 2015 numbers that Wisconsin has half of the solar workforce as our surrounding states, we still have a ways to go. But this is really huge progress. We've seen this progress on several fronts. One is through our utilities of different sorts, and one of them is Dairyland Power, which has literally doubled the amount of renewable energy for Wisconsin. They went out to bid and for up to a certain amount of energy from renewables, but of course it was going to be based on what the market prices were compared to traditional fuels, and they were able to almost max out what they had originally thought because the prices have been so price competitive. So they service western Wisconsin and Minnesota, parts of Minnesota, and they will be putting in 98 megawatts of wind, which is the first wind we've seen around here in over 5 years. And then 19 megawatts of solar across 14 projects. So that's really huge. What we've been seeing, though, locally has been very interesting. That's because municipalities, tribal governments, and schools have been launching projects. And then there have been groups that are community groups that have also found interesting ways to promote solar and get it installed and finance it. And I guess I should just put a plug in or an informational notice here that next month I'll be releasing a solar financing guide for municipal government folks. And so it might be useful to other people on the line as well. So in terms of what's going on locally, we found that the tribes have, we've had two tribes each get $1 million from the US DOE to install solar, and they're going ahead and installing solar on all of their government buildings. And so these were about, one of them is installing 800 kW of roof-mounted solar projects. That's the Oneida tribe, and then the Mole Lake tribe of Lake Superior, Chippewa in northwest Wisconsin has got $1 million, and they'll be installing 600 kW of PV on all 17 of their commercial buildings. So our tribes are really increasing their solar. In addition to that, we've had solar gardens going in. That's been mostly the activity there has been through the rural electric co-ops. they have done the most with solar gardens. And then we've also had solar group buy programs. So I don't, just to make sure everybody knows what it is I'm actually talking about, the solar group buy programs are when a group either hires an administrator to work with local residents and help them right up front learn about solar, take out any of the research that they have to do, so it presents them with the options, the cost, and then that group will actually go out and do a bid or do an RFP with installers and then get a group price that's lower than if people were to do it individually, because then the installer would be putting in several projects. And then that group can either contract with one or several installers. And so what we've found in Wisconsin, there's a group called Solar Chippewa Valley, and they've been administered by a group that they form called Chippewa Valley Affordable Solar. And they worked with our Midwest Renewable Energy Association, who was kind of the third party that they hired to do the education sessions for the local residents to look at whether their roofs were solar ready, et cetera. And they actually got 31 community members to subscribe, and they'll be generating 185 kW of solar. We've had other group buy programs going as well, and in Madison area, in Milwaukee's been doing it for the longest time. Obviously, they're not rural. We had one in Portage County through Northwind Renewable Energy that had 15 subscribers. So altogether, through these kinds of programs, there have been about 250 people who have put on distributed solar generation on their own roofs and generated over 1,000 kilowatts of solar. So that's another model that we're seeing. And then a third model that we're seeing are the what I call the community gardens. And with the community gardens, what we're finding is that the rural co-ops are putting these together. They're especially good for people who either don't have a good solar resource where their homes are, and so they aren't able to get good solar at home, or they don't want to, you know, go for the cost. They can't afford it that way. But in a solar garden project, they buy shares through their co-op that could cover a small amount of their power or their electricity needs or all of it, or depending on some of the co-ops have actually said, you know, you can only cover half of it so that everybody who wants it can get it. A lot of businesses, local rural businesses, have been participating in this, as well as municipalities and school districts. And so that's another model that's going on, and so we've seen solar gardens go in that are up to 500 watts of production, and the residents then get a rebate on their energy bill for the amount of electricity that they paid into that they're not going to get charged for the normal dirty coal rate on their bills that they're putting back into the grid. And so that's become something that's really popular. And then there are some of the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, in somewhat more rural areas although not fully rural, like Eau Claire and La Crosse on the western border of Wisconsin, so they have over 20,000 residents in those cities. But in that general area, they're putting in a megawatt of solar in each of those, outside of each of those two cities, and one on a closed landfill that the city owns. And then people are subscribing for that, and it took them only a few months to get over 90% subscribed, and they had more than 20 businesses and 80 homeowners buy into one of them. And everything from Gunderson Health and Mayo and Marshfield Clinic, so a lot of the healthcare industry, as well as the local governments, the technical college, some of the villages, the smaller villages, and even the Fort McCoy has bought into that. So
I'm seriously impressed that you have that much going on in Wisconsin right now. So. Yes,
it's happened.
We need to move on to Myra,
but
people can ask questions about it. But you know, wow, there's a lot happening. I think everybody else is probably a little surprised as well, considering the political environment in Wisconsin. So, go ahead, Myra. Do you want to talk a little bit about Ohio?
Yes, and actually, I've got four topics I'd like to talk about: our current energy mix, where we're generating, what sources we're using to generate power. What policies do we have that are impacting renewable energy? Some hopeful signs for growth that I see in the renewable energy field, and then what OSU Extension's role is in education, outreach, and research. So the first thing is the sources of power. Ohio is heavily dependent upon fossil fuels to generate its electricity. That's probably no surprise. We are a coal mining state, or at least have been traditionally. What's growing now, though, is natural gas, which is also a fossil fuel, but that's a result of the intense shale oil and gas development that's occurring in the state. But right now, or at least in 2015, coal represented 59% of our power source. Natural gas represented 23%, so those two fossil fuels combined are over 80%. Renewables was very small at only 2%, and that's the U.S. average is 14%. So, you know, and Indiana is 5%. So, I mean, we're way behind our neighbors, but I think some things are happening that are going to make that change. The first thing is a lot of our older coal plants are being shut down and will be closed. And over 10 gas-powered electrical generation plants are under development in Ohio in terms of producing electricity. So the policies and regulations, we've been a renewable portfolio standard state since 2008, and that mandated that the investor-owned utilities had to obtain 25% of their energy from what they call advanced energy sources, which does include clean coal, by 2025, but half of that 25% needed to come specifically from renewable sources. Now, in 2015 and 16, the state legislature, in its infinite wisdom, kind of listened to the utility companies and RPS standards were mandatory, they decided that they would be voluntary for 2 years. So 15 and 16, they were voluntary, which actually resulted in a freeze on utility investment in RE. They didn't need to do it, so they didn't. The legislature attempted to extend that for another 2 years, but our governor, Governor Kasich, vetoed the bill, which is good news. Quoting, a wide range of energy generation options is helping Ohio to grow jobs. So it does have a positive impact on the future of renewable energy. Unfortunately, with wind, we passed in 2014 some restrictive setback requirements, which restricted how close a turbine could be to an adjoining property, even if it was unoccupied. So that kind of put a little bit of a damper on some large-scale wind developments. Here are the hopeful signs I see. Like Wisconsin, our utilities, many of them are stepping up to the plate. The first one is AEP. They just sent out an RFP a few months ago for solar and wind proposals on new projects, and what they intend to generate is 100 megawatts of solar power and 250 megawatts of wind-powered electricity. Preferences given to projects in Appalachian, Ohio, which is a very rural area and also economically distressed. Part of this targeting was to help the economy in Appalachian, Ohio. The second thing is AEP has an overall pledge to generate 900 megawatts in Ohio of renewable energy. This is with an agreement with the Sierra Club. They're looking at 500 megawatts of wind and 400 megawatts of solar. So they are moving in that direction, recognizing that coal basically has little future, although we don't know what's going to happen with our new administration, but that's kind of another story. Okay, power co-ops like Wisconsin are also stepping up to the plate. And they are constructing, the one I live in is, or is serving me, is constructing a solar array with 400 panels, and customers can reserve any number of panels, usually based on your monthly energy usage. It's a little bit more expensive. I think what they're targeting at this point, until some of the costs come down, is those people who are environmentally conscious and want to use renewable energy. Now, also some communities, and I believe somebody reported on the village of Minster a few months ago, which has a population of less than 3,000, that is really innovative in that they combine solar energy field with an energy storage system, and they're able to generate 13% of their energy needs. Okay, let's look at business involvement in renewable energy, and I'm going to look at Amazon and what's happening in agriculture. Amazon has located two fulfillment centers in the state of Ohio, and a condition of locating those was that they were able to access wind power. The company is trying to become a zero fossil fuel using company nationwide. So they're putting a high emphasis on electricity from renewable sources, especially since their Amazon Web Service centers are high uses of energy. So they have constructed two wind farms in rural Ohio, one in Paulding County and one in Hardin County. Agriculture, we're looking at an increase in distributed energy generation systems. And to give you an idea of how the costs have come down, for a mid-sized solar system in 2010 on a farm, it was $6 a watt. Now the same system in spring of 2016 is $1.86 a watt, so the prices have come down. Now, finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about Extension Rural. We're an outreach and education arm of Ohio State University, and our mission is to take the research generated through the university and share it with communities and leaders and individuals and residents of Ohio in a way that is useful for them. So what we have is we have a website called Energize Ohio, which provides quite a bit of information that's easily accessible. We've developed curriculum around large-scale wind development to help local communities with decision-making, raising their decision-making capacity, and we do this kind of through a simulation game. We also are looking at community planning for shale oil and gas development to help those communities look at their larger energy picture and how they may be able to focus on social and environmental impacts in their community and address those as well as the economic. We have a solar awareness program with 4-H youth, which we use pizza boxes to demonstrate solar, so it's kind of interesting. We also have a traveling solar panel we use for on-site demonstrations. It goes to farms. It goes to our Farm Science Review every year. We have a series of fact sheets on our website for the University called Ohio Line, and we're assisting ag producers with solar distributed energy generation feasibility studies. We have quite a few large electric users, such as grain drying operations, and they're finding that distributed energy generation is helping them cut some of their costs. And finally, research. A few years ago, we had a project through the State Office of Energy where we looked at consumer attitudes, early adopters and not yet adopters towards energy efficiency and rural and renewable energy. And our current research is focusing on the environmental impact of gas and oil pipelines on agricultural lands and productivity of soils. So that, in a nutshell, is what's happening in Ohio.
Yes, it's good to hear there's a bit of a positive development in that area as well. So Matthew, why don't you talk to us about what's going on out in California there at Redwood Coast Energy Authority, and if you want to address a little bit about community choice aggregation, that would be great, especially in rural areas.
Yeah, so you know, we're in the process of launching community choice aggregation for Humboldt County, and the sort of steps that led us there, you know, we completed a couple years back a strategic plan called Repower Humboldt that sort of looked at what renewable resources we had in the county and to what extent those resources could meet our in-county energy needs. And the result of a lot of technical analysis was that it's actually quite feasible for us to, you know, get pretty close to 100% of our energy needs met from local renewable resources. And, you know, so the second question was, okay, well, the technical capability is there, the potential is there, how do we actually move that forward? And, you know, rather than saying, well, let's hope that somebody decides to come and, you know, do projects in our county and, you know, hope that the, you know, investor and utility prioritizes, you know, projects here, which, you know, in some cases might not be quite as cost effective as, like, you know, solar in the desert or something like that. And so, you know, we decided to move forward with community choice aggregation as a way to kind of have local control and be able to decide where our power is coming from and really use that as a vehicle to start developing local resources, which in our community includes biomass that uses, you know, waste from local mills that is sort of the existing local generation, and then we've got potential for wind as well as you know, solar, like everywhere, and even down the road potentially offshore wind and wave. We've got some of the best offshore wind and wave resource actually in the country. That technology is, you know, in more of a development stage, so that's, you know, a longer term strategy, but something that we're also interested in looking at. As far as launching it for a rural community, so, you know, the two kind of constraints we had, you know, were the fact that, well, we don't have a lot of financial resources to get it up and running and, you know, kind of get over that launch hurdle. And then the other piece of that was, you know, as a small, rural, fairly remote community, having kind of, you know, taking on the technical aspects of basically running a utility and you know, at our scale, the kind of challenges of, you know, how do we have the expertise and, you know, are we going to be able to afford kind of the staffing expertise to be able to really be effective? And so to overcome those two challenges, we basically took a slightly different approach than some of the other CCAs in California have done, and we issued a request for proposals that basically asked service providers to pretty much sort of work at risk and defer getting paid for the sort of technical analysis and everything up through the launch, and then to then get, you know, compensated during the sort of service term for like a four-year initial period of operations. And so basically we said, okay, it's a five-year, you know, contract. First year, you don't get paid, you help us get it up and running, and then, you know, recover the costs once we're up. And so we got a good response to that, which could have worked out otherwise. But you know, I think there's certainly a recognition in vendors that, you know, this was a way to kind of get over that hurdle rather than, you know, us trying to track down the funds to be able to launch the program and do the upfront work. You know, the other aspect of who we selected is we're kind of basing our model a lot more closely, I think, than at least the initial round of CCAs in California on the way that small municipal utilities have typically operated in a lot of cases. And to that regard, we ended up selecting for our kind of power procurement and portfolio management a company called the Energy Authority, or TEA, which is it's a nonprofit, and they've been around for many years, and they serve about 50 or so different municipal utilities and public power agencies across the country. And so, like small municipal utilities that, you know, don't necessarily have the scale to really, you know, have a lot of, you know, analytic, you know, number crunching abilities, and, you know, having an active trading desk and all that for power procurement. By working through them, we're basically kind of, you know, getting an economy of scale like their other public power agency customers, and being able to kind of tap into their capacity and technical expertise at a scale that works for us. And they're not the only company that has that model. I mean, there's the Northern California Power Authority, and there's other companies like ACES that have a similar model where, you know, these smaller utilities can basically, you know, sign up as a customer and then use that kind of shared capacity. And so those two things basically have let us kind of, you know, get to where we're launching in May of this year, and you know, we're able to have gotten there in a fairly short order and without having a lot of upfront cost through this model of having the vendors kind of do both the upfront work, and then, you know, to get us to launch, and then providing operational services. And then again, I think, you know, for a small community in particular, looking at the type of entities that serve municipal utilities as a service provider structure, so that you can get that kind of heavy hitting technical ability and fairly sophisticated power portfolio management capabilities that, you know, we would not be able to do in-house if we were trying to do it, you know, kind of within our shop with just staff. We wouldn't be able to have anywhere near that level of kind of sophistication in engaging the market. So that's kind of where we're at and what's happening up here.
Okay, thanks so much. Excellent discussion there. We're going to open this up to questions right now and just kind of dive in. If you do, please introduce yourself and where you're from, and then if you do say something a second time, just give your first name so people know who you are. Go ahead, somebody. Be shy. I know there's got to be questions.
Hi, this is Judy Schweitzer, Schweitzer & Associates in California. Amazing things going on. I'm so impressed and really glad I listened in today. How does this all work when you've got, whether it's let's say it's not so rural or maybe a greenfield development and you've got an investor-owned utility? Are you grid-tied or on the community choice aggregation, or is this something separate or independent from that?
Matthew, do you want to take that one, or?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I probably should have provided an intro to community choice aggregation. Yeah. So we take on the power procurement component of electricity service, while the investor and utility kind of continues to own and operate the grid itself. And so, and they also continue to do all the metering and customer, like, you know, interactions as far as connecting service. You know, so there's it's a sort of a hybrid model, you might say, in the sense that customers still just get one bill from, in our case, PG&E, and it's just the line on there that says generation that now becomes kind of our you know, purview. And so. So there is, as far as connecting, you know, renewables and things like that, you know, there's still, you know, there has to be an interaction with the utility as far as, you know, you're still using their grid. It's actually, I mean, for us, it's an excellent model because we don't have to, you know, it'd be a lot bigger project trying to take on, you know, the whole grid management. And obviously, you know, when there's an already existing entity that it you know, would be a definite point of conflict, whereas, you know, this approach lets us focus on where our electricity is coming from and potentially building new projects in the community while letting PG&E kind of, you know, continue to do the good job that they do in our community of maintaining the infrastructure.
Roger, thank you. Go ahead. Whoever's asking a question.
Yeah, hi. This is Craig Lewis with the Clean Coalition. Matthew and all everything talked about so far has been real interesting. My question is for Matthew on the TEA and the contractual arrangement that sounds like it's been entered into. That sounded like a very clever structure. My compliments to you to negotiating that. I just want to make sure I understand it. So it's a five-year contract. It includes a no-fee first year, or kind of they'll roll the fees and take the risk that those fees will get paid someday. And then starting after the first year and for the following 4 years after that, they will have a fee for supporting the operations of the CCA. So my question is, did I understand you correctly? Is that the proper structure? And then secondly, is what happens if the launch is delayed and it doesn't become operational until 2 years from now? And, you know, are those guys guaranteed to get some money, you know, after 1 year, even if it's not launched, or are they basically at risk and they can decide after 1 year if it's not launched whether to stick around and give some more pro bono support?
So that is the structure, and you know, our contract was, you know, fairly complicated about, you know, kind of different sort of trigger points, and so we broke it actually into three phases. The first phase was sort of the exploratory, like, well, let's do the technical, you know, study, see if it looks feasible, see what, you know, the numbers would look like, see what the timeline would be. And then for that period, it was truly at, you know, they were at risk. Like, we could just, you know, change your mind and say, well, it doesn't look so good, or we don't like the sound of it, and, you know, they just, you know, would be out and wouldn't get paid anything. After the second phase was when we say, okay, we've got the technical study, it looks good, we're actually proceeding with launching, that's when, you know, they and our other vendors, they're not the only one, we've also got, like, data management services and some other components, you know, that's when they would start to, you know, be, you know, spending real money on you know, making commitments and putting systems in place. And so for that second phase, we had, you know, a timeline, and there was kind of trigger points in there as far as, like, okay, you know, this is going to, you know, we're shooting for this date, but, you know, this has to be in place, this has to be in place. So if it had taken longer, it would have, you know, kind of, you know, it would have bumped the operational phase down the road. If we'd pulled back in that second second phase, where we'd said, yes, we're launching, and if for some reason we said, oh, no, wait, we're not launching all of a sudden, you know, then there was a provision where they would get, you know, some portion of their costs, you know, their actual costs reimbursed if we'd backed out after we already said we were, you know, pulling the trigger. So, you know, and we felt pretty confident about, well, one, our commitment to do it, certainly, and then, you know, as far as our timeline for launch, you know, we structured it in a way where we felt confident we could, you know, hit those milestones, and so, you know, we didn't really spend too much. It was more about, you know, if we changed our mind, you know, then we would be changing our mind, but, you know, we were, I think, fairly certain about launching in 2014. You know, we had flexibility in, or 2017, sorry, but, when the actual date of launch would be.
Yeah, so great. Thank you for that explanation. So do I get this right that the exploratory phase is up to a year? So that sounds like it's 12 months, and then they're at risk for the fees, but they can accumulate them and then spread. I guess they get spread out in the following 4 years, assuming that there's a go decision.
Yeah. So we exactly, and we started, you know, with working with them in April, and the, you know, the technical analysis kind of went through the summer, and then that's when, you know, I think it was late summer when we basically said, all right, we're actually doing this, we're pulling the trigger, you know, we're moving forward, we feel confident that it's good for our community, and then, you know, then we've been proceeding with kind of the build out. So we did our first round of power procurement with them in January. And so certainly at that point, once we've, you know, committed to power purchases, we kind of crossed the Rubicon. And so, you know, there's definitely, you know, we're past the point where we could turn back, really. I mean, barring some, you know, major disaster.
Okay. And so the exploratory phase was about 12 months. Did I get that right, or was that just...
Yeah, well, it was actually, you know, we spent about a year, year and a half prior to contracting with them, kind of doing our own assessment of how we wanted to proceed, whether we wanted to launch our own program, whether we wanted to, you know, look at joining, like, Sonoma's program or something like that. And then that led us to issuing RFP and then selecting TEA and the other vendors we're working with. And so the actual period with them to put together sort of the technical study that sort of looked at different scenarios and what, you know, kind of strategies we wanted to implement, that was, you know, more like, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so. And then following that, we've been really kind of just focused on not really analysis, but just ramping up to launch as far as getting in place all the various regulatory requirements and getting the data management system set up and all that.
And then the, I'm sorry to drill down on this, but it's a really interesting structure. So that, and then the second phase was basically a design and initial implementation phase, which sounds like you're kind of in that phase right now. How long do you anticipate that phase being, and when do you kind of cut over to phase three, which I think you characterized?
Yeah, so May is when we're beginning service to customers. So So from when we kind of basically contracted or began work with TEA and their team to serving customers is about a year period, pretty much 12 months. So we started kind of, you know, it was in the summer, you know, when we kind of said, all right, we're actually going to launch this thing, we're moving forward. And then that's when, you know, we started making commitments as far as, you know, going out and beginning the power procurement planning process, and then actually procuring power in January. And you know, we're sending mailers are going out actually next week to all the customers in the county for the first notification that's required by the law to all the customers. So
I gotcha. So they're basically rolling fees through the exploratory and the design and initial implementation
yeah. mm-hmm.
phase, and then they'll start collecting fees
right.
in the
yeah,
operation
so
phase starting in May.
Yeah. So they start getting paid in May, and then that'll continue for 4 years.
Awesome. Last question on this, and I know there's others that want to ask. Are the contracts something that can be shared? Because a lot of folks could learn from this. And
yeah, they're on our webpage, and I'm happy to send them to anybody that they might. I'm not sure if you might have to drill down a little bit to find them. So,
send me an email with your information to Matthew, and I'll make sure the group gets it.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Anybody else?
This is
Evan Hughes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Evan.
I'm an energy consultant in Menlo Park, California. My question concerns what guarantees are made regarding rates to people who sign up to be in the CCA, and is it your provider, TEA, who makes those guarantees, or is it you as a CCA?
You know, so we as a local government agency set the rates. Obviously, we work with them to develop, you know, what, you know, that looks like, but our board has rate-setting authority, and so, you know, they could, in theory, set rates that are higher. You know, I think none of them are interested in doing that from a political standpoint, since they're accountable to the public. And so, you know, we did our rate setting in January, and our rates are, you know, as far as the bottom line of the bill is going to be, you know, not a giant savings, a few percent below PG&E's rates, but we're basically aiming for a total of $2 million countywide rate savings per year, you know, in aggregate of all customers. So, you know, keeping an extra $2 million in the county in the form of rate savings is kind of our target, which we're on track for.
I have a follow-up on that. We have heard in previous programs here on municipal sustainability that some CCAs are working toward building up a reserve to cover contingencies problems going forward. Are you doing that out of that $2 million of savings, or how does that work?
No. So in addition to the $2 million in rate savings, so our year one reserve target, which is built into our rates and our budget, is $6 million at the end of year one. And our goal is to get up to at least a $10 million reserve by the end of the first 5 years with potentially more than that, depending on how market conditions are. But definitely $6 million in the first year. We're on track for that, and then shooting for at least $10 million overall as far as a buffer fund.
We have here in San Mateo County, California, a CCA, Peninsula Clean Energy, and they made an adjustment in their, not in their bottom line of their rates, but in how they distribute the costs, because the fee allowed by the Public Utilities Commission allowed PG&E to charge a fee, and that went up, and so our Peninsula Clean Energy adjusted how they charge us to keep with their bottom line guarantee, which I think was 5% below PG&E.
Yeah, the PG&E sort of exit fees that are ongoing and variable from year to year is definitely one of the kind of challenging things you have to work and manage around, because it changes each year, and this year went up, and that's, when I say a couple percent savings, that's including that fee. So our actual rate is maybe 30% below PG&E's, but then you take that fee into account, and so it's only a couple percent.
Now, a final question on this, compared to our experience, do you have a plan for 100% renewable versus some standard package that may be less than 100% renewable?
Yeah, so we're following that approach of our sort of standard offer, or standard product would be increasing renewable over what PG&E's got in their mix by a modest amount, as well as shooting for lower greenhouse gas emissions factor overall. But we'll have an opt-up option that'll be a penny per kilowatt hour premium for customers to go 100% renewable if they want to.
Somebody else had a question here at the same time Evan started.
This is Jerry Braun in Davis, California. Of course, the CCA discussion is very interesting in California. I could spend all day on that. I want to direct a question to Sherry and Myra. Very encouraging and very nicely summarized reports. One thing that interests me is whether, to what extent local jurisdictions like cities and counties are coming up the learning curve and actually engaging with the local energy service providers, and how is that dialogue engagement between the energy service provider and the local jurisdiction, how's that working? Is it starting to work, and is it helping in terms of getting renewables deployed in the rural areas?
Well, this is Sherry. That's a very interesting question. I think we found that with the IOUs, when the municipalities have tried to do third-party financing, for instance, which in Wisconsin law is really unaddressed by our PSC, there had been a few challenges by the IOUs saying, if you do this, we're going to call you a utility and you'll have to be regulated as a utility. Iowa case law a year ago didn't support that, and the utilities have backed down. They have been working in partnership. I would say that in the rural electric co-ops and with the municipal utilities, they've been working really well with their local governments. And Sierra had said she was surprised that there was this much activity, and given our political situation. But I would say that all of what we're seeing is really from the ground up. that the charge, the lead, and I would say a lot of the progress has been from the local municipalities. They want to make this happen. One of the programs I didn't get to talk about is in Wisconsin. We also, in the last year, formed a Wisconsin PACE program, and through the leadership of the Counties Association, and we have now 12 counties, many of them rural, who've agreed to this with a third-party commission to loan money for, they're starting commercial PACE, not just for energy efficiency, but also for renewables. It's just started, and we've only seen energy efficiency projects being applied for just yet. But that's another route that's gone on. So anyway, if that's helpful. I should also say we have our program in Wisconsin is under the extension. We call it Energy On Wisconsin. And so we have a website and monthly newsletters, and we post, you know, what's going on if anybody wants to look at it. It's energyonwi.uwex.edu.
Thank you.
This is Myra.
Go ahead, Myra.
Yeah, this is Myra. I would agree with Sherry. I think that what we're seeing, if any kind of municipal engagement is happening, it's through the municipal utilities, municipal-run utilities, and through the rural electric co-ops. And the co-ops really seem to be stepping up to the table to, you know, try to encourage renewable energy. Other than that, and other than a few examples, like the Village of Minster, I'm not seeing that much. And I don't know whether Roger Wilkins might want to join in on this one, if he's seeing any. And I know Athens area is doing some interesting things, but in the communities I work in, it does not seem to be a high priority now, I must say.
Yeah, this is Roger Wilkins from Athens, Ohio. I'm right in the center of Appalachian, Ohio, and so rural organizing is a major concern of ours. And as Myra was mentioning, we do have a fair amount of activity down here, and we're taking steps to try to expand into contiguous counties. A few years ago, we started the Southeast Ohio Public Energy Council, which is a council of governments and a CCA. And it is making some inroads into neighboring counties. And we have a network of nonprofit organizations that are doing some of the on-the-ground organizing work. And that's what it really takes. Is people getting out, going to churches and community groups and schools and other places in the surrounding counties and talking about how important it is for people to organize and then to reach out to the utilities and to other agencies to collaborate with them, but not to simply sit and wait for the larger organizations to come to us. And we're having some degree of success with that. But as Myra mentioned earlier, the sort of the legislative and regulatory environment in Ohio isn't very supportive. We had the regulatory freeze on standards for a couple of years. And so in our area, we've been looking for ways to sort of work around the absence of supportive legislation. For example, we don't have any supports for community solar in Ohio. And so we're now looking at a Department of Energy grant that would help us create a community investment corporation approach that would fill that gap. We're also looking at a new concept that's starting to crop up of an aggregator of supply of distributed energy resources. and there are places where there are experiments with forming what are called virtual power plants that are aggregating a lot of really small distributed generation. And in a few instances, more outside this country than in the U.S., it's actually supplanting coal-fired power plants with an aggregated combination of renewables. And
could I just ask, is that the same as green power purchase, you know, where you can buy renewable energy credits or greenie certified energy from distributed sources?
That is closer to a subscriber model for community solar, but community solar is usually focused in a local area, where I think what you're talking about is more widespread and not geographically located. In this case, it would be some agency, either a government, Council of Governments like SOPEC is, Southeast Ohio Public Energy Council, or a private cooperative entity that would actually be buying the power from a lot of microgrids, nanogrids, and rooftop producers, and having the capacity, the software, and the hardware to aggregate that and then present it back to the grid in such a way that it would play the same supply role as any other power plant does. And
Roger, I've got a question about that, because one of the stresses it seems we're facing in Ohio is distributed energy generation and net metering. And what I'm hearing is that the investor-owned utilities are concerned that they will not be able to recoup their sunken costs if they have a lot of distributed energy generators who are doing net metering through the grid. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do, and it's not just in Ohio that we're seeing that across the country, I think, where utilities are trying to figure out how to adapt to this energy transition to renewable sources. And the battleground right now is around net metering, but there are larger questions that are being grappled with. One of the sources that I just saw yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to really dive into it, is a massive study out of MIT called The Utility of the Future. And I was encouraged to see that Ohio was one of the states that signed on to utilizing that information. And I think it's going to provide a basis for Ohio and a number of other states to look at how they can do some things similar to what New York is doing with its Reforming the Energy Vision program, or Massachusetts, or, of course, California is doing a lot with particularly community choice aggregation. But it's very much, in my view, a transitional period where things are being worked out. And the utilities are, I think, very concerned with their sunken assets, as they say. But as it was mentioned earlier, there is a continuing role in terms of transmission and distribution, and particularly as they bring more storage into the mix at all scales, both utility scale and more community scale, that can really mitigate the need for more plants, peaker plants, that are just sit idly until the few hours when they're needed and are ramped up. So there's a lot to transition on, and the focus is on net metering, but that isn't where I think all the issues can be productively resolved.
Can I jump in here. This is Craig Lewis, and I really appreciate the comments that were just made about the, you know, the ability for local renewables and other distributed energy resources to reduce the need for new transmission investments, which is a huge deal because transmission is exorbitantly expensive. The Clean Coalition is running a campaign in California to rationalize the way that transmission costs are allocated, which will essentially make a bright line distinction between how much money distributed energy resources save in avoided transmission costs and future avoided transmission investments, which directly translates into transmission costs because utilities get to make those investments with a guaranteed rate of return of over 10% in California. It's pretty similar around the rest of the country. The campaign is called Transmission Access Charges Campaign. It's on our website. There's lots of information on our website. I would encourage anybody who's dealing with transmission issues to look at the California Transmission Access Charges Campaign. We've got legislation that's going to be introduced by Friday, the last day to get introduced. So we've got the fix is being pursued both through the regulatory bodies and in parallel through legislative action. And we've got lots of information about it. I'd love to collaborate with other parties around the country in how to make sure that transmission costs are really moved into a very, you know, into focus and put the spotlight on transmission costs and the ability for distributed energy resources, especially local renewables, energy storage, et cetera, to reduce the need for new transmission investments.
Craig, this is Samuel Golden. Are you getting adequate support or proactive support from the current CCAs and the Cal CCA group?
You know, we've got Sean Marshall through LEAN is on board, which we're very grateful for. But we've had a real hard time getting the existing CCAs to put their name in a public manner, in a visible manner. And if you go to Samuel, thank you for chiming in. I'm really glad you're on the call and that you're inquiring here because we'd love to partner with you on this. The CCAs, I think, are there's two issues with the existing CCAs in California in terms of getting them to formally endorse the Transmission Access Charges Campaign, is what is called the TAC campaign. Number one, I think they're afraid of the politics, right, and pissing the investor-owned utilities off that they're subjected to, right, for billing and everything, you know, so much of the services and the distribution lines and interconnection and the rest of it. But number two is that they're short-staffed, and they just don't have the manpower to dig into the issues. It's a complex issue. You know, Clean Coalition has done as the best we can to make it, you know, clear and straightforward, but it still is dealing with, you know, very nuanced issues. And it takes somebody, you know, probably a couple of hours to read through materials and really wrap their head around it. We're happy to conduct telecons and webinars and whatever to help explain it to people, but those are the two you know, barriers that I've seen, Samuel, in terms of getting the, you know, the MCEs and Sonomas and, you know, any other formal CCA to endorse the campaign. At this point, I'm not sure if we have any of the existing CCAs on board as formal endorsements, but we should have all of them. This is a they're the biggest beneficiary of getting this transmission access charge allocation corrected. And the reason is that they would get a 3 cents per kilowatt hour benefit for procuring local renewables instead of, you know, what they're all out there buying, you know, centralized renewables because centralized renewables and local renewables are both paying the same amount for transmission costs when the local renewables are not using the transmission grid, and it's completely counter to California's usage pays principle, which is the way that transmission costs are supposed to be allocated.
This is Sherry. Is this the value of solar tariff that you're talking about, or is it very similar to that Austin and Minnesota have done? Hello?
I don't know if you were addressing me, Craig Lewis, but that the transmission access charges are completely separate from the value of solar tariffs. That question was addressed to.
Okay.
Well, we're going to have to end this pretty quick here. This is Sierra. Yeah, we need to have obviously more calls around this topic. Very interesting conversation, and I'm open to ideas on calls. This is your meeting, so tell me what you want to talk about, and I'll set it up for you. It could be more than once a month. So anyhow, I just want to let you know that Matthew Marshall is going to be presenting next week on the talking about rural energy and renewable energy in rural areas and expanding on that topic some more. And I appreciate all of you coming. If you have any need to contact anybody else in the group, you can go to the mseforum.com and then look up Connect on the left-hand side, and then there's a list of the leaders. So all your contact information is over there.
Hey, Sierra.
And yes.
Sorry, real quick. This is Craig again. If there's interest amongst the group, I'd be happy to have the Clean Coalition provide a webinar on the transmission cost allocation issue in California and the campaign around fixing it. I throw that out there right now in case folks, you know, want to voice in and say, yes, that would be interesting, or no, we've already got a busy schedule with lots of other interesting topics.
Well, you know, we should talk because I'm looking for something for April and May. So I'm not sure it'd be just exactly that for the entire webinar, but we can certainly combine that possibly with another one. And we actually did have a webinar on that not too long ago. So but let's talk about that, Craig.
Okay.
So anybody else? Any other comments? We'll go ahead and end it. I know there's a lot to talk about. And again, you can reach each other on the mseforum.com and then look up Connect, and all your contact information will be there. If you have anything you want me to send out to the group, go ahead and email it to me, and I can forward to the group all this interesting information. And Sherry, you were talking about a guide that's going to be a financing guide to municipalities. And mm-hmm. I think that would be of interest to everybody, too. So when you get that done, you also have a survey, Myra, that you did. That when you get that done, if you wouldn't mind sending that to me, to the people who answered the survey, and we'll go ahead and get that out to people as well.
Hey, Sierra.
Thanks again.
Sierra, before you completely close, I just want to say that I misspoke in my answer to the value of solar tariff, because if you get the transmission costs properly allocated, you add 3 cents per kilowatt hour to the value of solar tariff, and we're seeing that in California, in the municipal utilities that actually pay their transmission cost allocations correctly, and they're able to add the avoided transmission costs onto their value of solar tariffs, which you know, basically through net metering, the wholesale, that whatever you export, lots of municipal utilities now have converted to paying a value of solar tariff for grid exports and under net metering. So yes, the answer is there is a very direct connection there with value of solar tariffs and transmission cost allocation, getting that rationalized.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for clarifying that. Okay, thanks. We'll see you all next time. Thanks for coming. Thanks to our presenters. Excellent job to Matthew, Sherry, and Myra. Good information. I hope people can use it. All right. Talk
thanks.
To you soon. All right.
Thank you.
Bye.